From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Oh, what a joyful day this is. We have just learned that James is coming home. He has been released unharmed with his companions, Harmeet and Norman.
The three remaining members of the Christian Peacemakers team are free after being held as hostages for almost 4 months. They were seized last November along with U.S. peace activist Tom Fox, whose body was found in Baghdad 2 weeks ago. Then new questions are being raised over whether the Bush administration's warrantless domestic spy program is more extensive than has been acknowledged.
I believe that my office and my home has been visited by representatives of the federal government, and I suspect without a warrant. And that's what we'll be speaking about today.
We'll speak with a Portland attorney. Then Shia death squads in Iraq have been systematically targeting gay Iraqis for persecution and execution. We'll talk with a gay Iraqi living in exile in London and the reporter who broke the story. And we'll look at the latest in the student protests in France. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, three members of the Christian Peacemakers team have been freed after being held hostage for almost 4 months. British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw announced the men had been rescued earlier today. The exact circumstances of their release remain unclear. According to a statement from the Christian Peacemaker team, no one was hurt in the rescue. The rescued men are Norman Kember of Britain, James Loney, and Harmeet Singh Sudan, both of Canada. Across the globe, families and friends of the men have been rejoicing. This is a message the Loney family put on their phone answering machine earlier today.
Oh, what a joyful day this is. We have just learned that James is coming home. He has been released unharmed with his companions, Harmeet and Norman. We would like to thank everyone for their support and prayers. At this time, we would also like to express our deepest sympathy to the family of Tom Fox.
The men were seized in Baghdad last November, along with the U.S. peace activist Tom Fox, whose body was found in Baghdad 2 weeks ago. He'd been shot and his body was dumped on a Baghdad street. The peace activists are all members of the humanitarian group, the Christian Peacemaker Teams, which has been documenting the abuse of Iraqi detainees and working with the families of prisoners. The CPT were the first to publicly denounce the torture of Iraqis at the hands of U.S. forces long before the media revealed what was happening at Abu Ghraib. Meanwhile, an army dog handler has been sentenced to 6 months in prison for abusing Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib. The sergeant, Michael Smith, was photographed using unmuzzled dogs to terrify detainees. He could have been sentenced to 8.5 years in prison, but he was given a far shorter sentence. Smith is the 10th low-ranking soldier convicted of taking part in the widespread abuse at Abu Ghraib. To date, no high-ranking officer or anyone in civilian command has been held accountable for what happened at the prison. In labor news, cutbacks in the auto industry are continuing. General Motors has announced plans to offer early retirement buyouts to all of its 113,000 unionized workers here in the United States. The plan, which has the backing of the United Auto Workers, will also affect workers at the auto supplier Delphi General Motors, is trying to eliminate 30,000 hourly jobs by 2008. In Gaza, the Guardian newspaper is reporting widespread bread rationing has been introduced because of severe food shortage. Israel's cut off deliveries of flour and other essential items for most of the past 2 months. One UN official said food ration coupons are needed because stores lack flour, sugar, oil, milk, and other basic items. It's estimated 2/3 of the bakeries and many restaurants in Gaza have been forced to close. In Bolivia, an American man has been arrested along with an Uruguayan woman for bombing two hotels in La Paz. Two people died. At least seven were injured in the blast. The attacks were denounced by the Bolivian government. President Evo Morales said, quote, "This American was putting bombs in hotels. The U.S. government fights terrorism, and they send us terrorists," he said. Police initially identified the American as 24-year-old Claudio Lestad of New Orleans, but he reportedly used several other names. Police said he might be mentally ill. In environmental news, the Wall Street Journal is reporting that a fake watchdog group, largely subsidized by ExxonMobil, was responsible for getting the IRS to audit the environmental group Greenpeace. 2 years ago, the little-known Public Interest Watch challenged Greenpeace's tax-exempt status and accused the group of money laundering and other crimes. According to the Journal, tax records show ExxonMobil provided more than 95% of the funding of Public Interest Watch. John Passacantando, executive director of Greenpeace USA, said, quote, "I believe organizations should be scrutinized and audited, but I just don't believe you should get targeted because you're a critic of ExxonMobil." In news from the Middle East, military analyst William Arkin has revealed the Pentagon has developed a 10-year plan to store munitions and equipment in at least 6 countries in the Middle East and Central Asia in order to be prepared for future military conflicts. The countries include Bahrain, Kuwait, Qatar, and Oman, as well as a classified Middle Eastern country west of Saudi Arabia. According to Arkin, the military will use the sites to store everything from missiles to prepackaged, ready-to-eat meals. Meanwhile, in South Korea, a group of activists and farmers are planning 4 days of demonstrations outside the U.S. military base Camp Humphreys. The South Korean government has taken legal control over 2,000 acres of nearby farmland to enable the U.S. to triple the size of its base. Many local farmers are refusing to abandon their homes and land. In Washington, the Supreme Court has rejected an effort to give residents of Puerto Rico the right to vote in U.S. presidential elections. This is Puerto Rican political analyst Juan Manuel Garcia Pasalacqua.
No territory of the United States has ever been able to participate in the presidential elections of the United States of America. That fact only serves to underscore that Puerto Rico is now in the thinking of the United States Supreme Court, a miserable colony of the United States.
Puerto Rican political analyst Juan Manuel Garcia Pasalacqua. In news on the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, officials in New Orleans are warning the city remains without any emergency hurricane shelters, even though the hurricane season begins in about 2 months. Meanwhile, a new study estimates as many as 500,000 Katrina evacuees might need mental health counseling to deal with stress-related issues. In medical news, the Los Angeles Times reports one of the first independent studies of the new Medicare prescription benefit law has concluded many low-income California seniors have access to a narrower range of drugs than when the state covered their medications. In Tennessee, the Capitol building in Nashville was forced to close its doors to visitors after several hundred protesters, many of them in wheelchairs, blockaded nearby streets. Nearly 100 of the protesters were arrested during what was the second day of demonstrations organized by the group Americans Disabled for Attendant Programs, or ADAPT. ADAPT is opposing recent cuts to health care funding in the state that disenrolled 330,000 residents from the state's health insurance program. This is Babs Johnson, longtime member of ADAPT, speaking by cell phone from the midst of the protest Tuesday.
Right now, ADAPT has shut down Charlotte Avenue in front of the Capitol here in Tennessee because of the unjust and immoral incarceration of people with disabilities in nursing homes. The state spends $160 on institutional placement for every dollar that goes into community services, and we want to change that.
Babs Johnson of ADAPT. In Nepal, police have raided the home of one of the country's top opposition leaders, Madhav Kumar, Nepal, the head of the Communist Party of Nepal. Armed police raided his house without a warrant and seized his telephone, computer, and fax machine. Mr. Nepal has been under house arrest for the past 2 months and had already had his phone disconnected. Nepal has been a key organizer of the nationwide protests against Nepal's King Gyanendra, who seized complete control of the government last year. And in Peru, head of the rebel group MRTA, or the revolutionary movement Tupac Amaru, has been sentenced to 32 years in jail. The man, Victor Pole Campos, has been in jail since 1992. A military court originally sentenced him to life in prison, but the conviction was later ruled unconstitutional. And in New York, The police response to the Republican National Convention protests is continuing to come under criticism. For the first time, a high-ranking police supervisor has admitted that police arrested about 400 people at Union Square, even though the police never gave an order to disperse. The disclosure was made in a deposition by Deputy Inspector James Essig. On Wednesday, the New York Civil Liberties Union accused the police of lying about the circumstances surrounding the mass arrests of protesters. Up until now, the police maintained the protesters were all told to disperse before they were arrested. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers out there. New questions are being raised over whether the Bush administration's warrantless domestic spy program is more extensive than has been acknowledged. This week, U.S. News & World Report revealed the Bush administration attempted to authorize government agents to perform physical searches without court warrants. A government official said FBI Director Robert Mueller objected to the proposal, quote, not only because of the blowback issue, but also because of the legal and constitutional questions raised by warrantless physical searches. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with someone who alleges he's been subjected to these physical searches. But first, we go back a month to Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. On February 7th, Gonzalez appeared before the Senate Judiciary Committee to explain the Bush administration's domestic eavesdropping program. Here, he is being questioned by Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy.
Well, then let me ask you this. Under your interpretation of this, can you go in and do mail searches? Can you go into emails? Can you open mail? Can you do black bag jobs?
Sir, no.
And under the idea that you don't have much time to go through what you describe as a cumbersome procedure, what most people think is a pretty easy procedure, get a FISA warrant, can you go and do that? Of Americans.
Sir, I've tried to outline for you and the committee what the president has authorized, and that is all that he has authorized.
Did it authorize the opening of first-class mail of U.S. citizens? Just that you can answer yes or no.
There is all kinds of wild speculation about what...
Did it authorize it?
Well, let him finish.
There is all kinds of wild speculation out there about what the president has authorized and what we're actually doing. And I'm not going to get into a discussion, Senator, about...
Mr. Attorney General, you're not answering my question. I'm not asking what the president authorized. Does this law, you're the chief law enforcement officer of the country, does this law authorize the opening of first-class mail of U.S. citizens? Yes or no, under your interpretation?
Senator, I think that, again, that is not what is going on here. We're only focused on communications in... international communications, where one part of the communication is al-Qaeda. That's what this program is all about.
You haven't answered my question.
Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy questioning Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez last month. Well, weeks later, Gonzalez wrote a follow-up letter attempting to clarify his testimony. Referring to his remark that the president has only authorized, Gonzalez wrote, quote, I did not and could not address any other classified intelligence activities. I was confining my remarks to the terrorist surveillance program as described by the president. Gonzalez's letter prompted Bruce Fein, a former government lawyer who served under three presidents, to comment, quote, it seems to me he's conceding there are other NSA surveillance programs ongoing that the president hasn't told anyone about. Well, today we're going to speak with someone who believes he's been subjected to another surveillance program, Thomas Nelson. He's an attorney based in Portland, Oregon. In a letter to a district U.S. attorney in September, Nelson wrote, quote, in the past 9 months, I and others have been strong indications that my office and my home have been the target of clandestine searches. Nelson believes these searches are related to his representation of a terror suspect. In a broadcast exclusive, Thomas Nelson joins us from a studio in Portland, Oregon. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us what you believe happened to you?
Well, beginning about January or February of last year, there were increasing indications that both my office in Portland, Oregon, and later my home had been visited. And the indications were cumulative and to the point where one of my office mates, a person with whom I share the office, another attorney, on several occasions found a person in the office going in our general office going to my office who didn't appear to be authorized to do so. These events continued, including indications that our home had been visited in our absence because of anomalies with the burglar alarm, to the point where the more I thought about it, the more I thought I should raise this to somebody. My concerns were in part related to my prior representation of Brandon Mayfield, who had similar visits by law enforcement personnel when he was wrongly accused of being involved in the Madrid train bombing. He, of course, was exonerated, but in that interim, he and his family noted that his home and his office had been visited. They had concrete evidence of that, and ultimately the FBI admitted to it. I assumed that the same thing was happening to me, and I wanted at least to register an objection with the United States Attorney, who is responsible for conducting or overseeing those kinds of searches. Apparently, however, the NSA was at that time conducting operations also, and I now believe that it was the NSA, not the FBI, that was involved.
Could you give us some more examples of incidents that you think were clearly indications that there had been unauthorized visits?
Yes. Backing up, the when nobody's in the office, the janitorial crew comes in generally. They will come in if somebody's there, but they normally come in after nobody's there. And when they come in, they do not disturb any papers or deal with any of the documents, other items. On a number of occasions, however, beginning again in January or February of last year, I would come in and note that my materials had been moved around, had been displaced. Then it escalated to the point where on several occasions, I think three, I noted that my computer had been changed. I normally left my computer on, and one instance I came in, it was off. On a second instance when I came in, the computer had been rebooted, but because there was a floppy in the A drive, it stopped rebooting, and so it didn't come on again with an error message saying, take the disk out of the A drive and we'll continue rebooting. I hadn't rebooted it. I hadn't turned it off. After that, Mr. Norling, who is an attorney and a former partner of mine, we continue to share office space, on two or three occasions found a person who was not a member of, or who didn't appear to be a member of the cleaning staff, coming into our office late at night, in one instance 2 a.m., coming into the general offices, turning on all the lights when Mr. Norling was trying to get a nap on his couch. Those events continued in that fashion. After that, I was working on a case, as you indicated in your lead into the story, involving a person accused of being a terrorist. I took all of my files up to our home in Zigzag, which is a mountain community approximately 50 miles east of Portland. And when I did that, we noted on, I think, two occasions that there was an anomaly in the alarm system where the power had been cut, but the authorities, the alarm company, didn't call us. It's part of their agreement with us that when there is a cut in power supply, they will call us. They didn't do it, didn't leave a message anywhere. So we called them, and we asked, what's going on here? Why didn't you call us? And all we got was stonewalling and stalling. My wife, as a matter of fact, waited for a better part of a night for a tech representative from the alarm company to call back. Never called back, never got a hold of us. I raised the issue with the office, first with the security personnel at the office, and they told me they're not going to talk to me. So they referred me to the building owner, and the building owner's manager and I had to sit down over coffee, and I said, what's going on here? Why are these things happening? Why I think somebody's coming in my office. Again, this was pre-disclosure of the NSA activities. I didn't get satisfaction. So as a result of all of these factors, I thought it best to raise the issue publicly, or certainly not publicly, but privately with U.S. Attorney for the District of Oregon, indicating that we were concerned that our office and our home were being visited and searched at night, or in our case, at home when nobody was there.
We're talking to Thomas Nelson, attorney based in Portland, Oregon, who believes the government has been conducting clandestine searches of his home and office. He represents several terror suspects, and we'll ask him about them and his lawsuit against the National Security Agency in a minute. Leonard Cohen's Democracy, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting on over 400 stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR, Low Power FM, community and college radio stations, as well as on PBS and public access TV stations on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. We're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. You can also find our transcripts there. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guest is Thomas Nilsen, an attorney in Portland, Oregon, who believes that government agents have conducted clandestine searches of his home and office. Juan?
Mr. Nilsen, you have a lawsuit that's been filed against the NSA where you allege that you've got clear evidence of intercepts. Could you, what can you tell us about that lawsuit and your decision to file it?
Certainly. The lawsuit alleges that the NSA engaged in what we think are illegal intercepts or wiretaps of communications between two attorneys in Washington, D.C., and an individual in Saudi Arabia who was at that time the director of an Oregon corporation called the Al Haramain Islamic Foundation, Inc. And we, in our complaint, allege that those intercepts occurred between February and May of 2004, and that the intercepts were, once they were obtained, were used by the government in a, if you will, a secret manner, now not so secret, but in a secret manner to harm the interests of the corporation. And, of course, the attorneys who were talking to the director. There's two issues here. There's, number one, the illegal intercepts. And there's number two, the attorney-client issue, because the communications that were occurring were between an attorney on the one hand, or two attorneys on the one hand, and a director of the corporation on the other.
Can you explain exactly? I mean, this is very significant, the evidence that you have. Looking at a Christian Science Monitor piece, it says that of all the lawsuits that are suing the NSA, it looks like yours may provide the federal courts with the most detailed glimpse yet into the clandestine counterterrorism effort. And that's because the biggest challenges for these cases, which have been filed in New York, Michigan, and California, is that plaintiffs don't have access to records of highly classified government surveillance activities and therefore can't be sure they were personally subjected to covert phone tapping or email reading by the U.S. government. But yours, the Oregon suit, may manage to leap over that imposing legal hurdle because you've apparently seen these phone logs and other top secret records that were inadvertently provided to you. How are they inadvertently provided?
Yeah, that's something I really am very uncomfortable discussing because we did file a document with the court when we filed our complaint, and the document was placed under seal based on our request. We wanted to make sure that we didn't cross any lines and we didn't disadvantage our clients. But let me say this, Amy, that we have specified chapter and verse, time and place. Involving intercepted communications between the attorneys and the client. I think there's been some coverage nationally regarding at least one aspect of that and some allegations. And if you want to go back, take a look at the Dave Ottaway report in the, I think it's March 3 issue of the Washington Post, where he talks about his obtaining a document that according to that article was classified, and how he had it for a while, then the FBI came and brought it back. I'm not saying that we have the same document, and I'm not saying we don't. I'm just saying that there was a document out there that apparently had chapter and verse in it. Our document, or our material, is of course under seal. The local paper, the Oregonian, has moved to open unseal the document, and the United States government has been opposing that, and I expect it will oppose it very vigorously.
Now,
so I can't really get into the substance of that document.
Now, your involvement or problems apparently with the government date back several years, since back in the late 90s when a Saudi Arabian charity was challenged by the government as a possible group involved in money laundering for Chechen rebels. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk about that. The corporation was a straightforward Islamic charity. Basically, its primary mission was to distribute Islamic literature and make contact with people who were interested in Islam. And it did that through a prayer house in Ashland, Oregon. It also had a large number of religious volumes that it would pass out to people, send to people who requested them, and they would basically try to do the outreach that in a missionary fashion, in a low-key missionary fashion. The corporation went along fine until 2004 when investigations were started. What the government has alleged early on was that the corporation was engaged in some form of terrorism without specifying it, but then they did they went to indict the corporation, and they didn't indict him for anything related to terrorism. Rather, they indicted the corporation and the director in Saudi Arabia for taking some money out of the country without declaring it to customs officials. No mention of terrorism. We have asserted all along that the corporation has nothing to do with terrorism. As a matter of fact, it was a branch of a Saudi Arabian charity called Al Haramain that itself has been dissolved by the Saudi Arabian government, and now those charitable activities are being undertaken by under direct supervision of the Saudi Arabian government. But in any event, we have contended throughout that there's no basis for any allegation that the Al Haramain Organization Oregon was involved in any way in terrorism. As a matter of fact, when the corporation was formed in 1999, long before 9/11, specific in the Articles of Corporation was a statement by its co-founder, Pete Seda. We abhor all forms of terrorism. We oppose all forms of terrorism. Those people who know the individuals involved, Pete Seda, Soleiman al-Buthi, and others, including a Zionist rabbi down in Ashland, know that these are people of peace and people who want to do nothing more than outreach. As a matter of fact, Mr. al-Buthi, who's indicted for taking the money out of the country, he currently is employed by the city of Riyadh as a assistant director of beautification. Basically, he's the flower guy, as I call him. He is responsible for the second annual Riyadh Flower Festival. He has been investigated by his own government. His own government, of course, is strongly opposed to and opposed by al-Qaeda. The fact that he continues to hold a government job, notwithstanding what we think are spurious United States government allegations, says a lot.
And on the issue of Brandon Mayfield, you were one of his attorneys?
Yeah, I was early on. Brandon and I go back probably 10 years prior to his arrest, before he became a law student, went to law school, and then got out of law school. I mentored him through that process. So when Brandon was arrested, I got a call from the U.S. Attorney's Office saying, "Do you know Brandon?" I said, "Of course I do." They asked me down, and I talked to Brandon, his concern at that time, frankly, wasn't so much about the criminal proceedings. He was being held as a material witness to the Madrid train bombings. His concern was his family. I'm not a criminal lawyer, so I told him, "No, the first thing you have to worry about is getting yourself a criminal lawyer." We made an appearance, Brandon and I, and the United States Attorney and FBI agents in a secret proceeding in front of Judge Jones, at which point I said, "Mr. Mayfield needs experienced expert criminal representation. So I told His Honor that I would go do that, and I did that. I then went and visited with his family, and during the 2 weeks that that Brandon was incarcerated,
And just to remind our viewers and listeners, Brandon Mayfield Wright picked up after the attacks in Spain. They said they found his fingerprints, although they ultimately exonerated him and said that they were wrong.
That's right. At that time, it was a terrible time. And this goes kind of ties into the story you're talking about today, because when my first meeting with the family in their home over in Beaverton, which is east or west of Portland, they told me that they had seen indications over the last several weeks that there were people coming in their house when they weren't there. Things like doors being locked that they hadn't left locked. Other indications that their materials had been dealt with. Ultimately, of course, Mr. Mayfield, during that process, during that two-week period, there was a lot of hysteria, some of it generated by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. There are two quotes that stick in my mind, one to Michael Isikoff of the Newsweek magazine, where the Federal Bureau of Investigation unnamed source said that the Mayfield fingerprint was a absolutely incontrovertible match. Those are three words quoted. Another report in the L.A. Times said that it was a, quote, bingo match, end quote. These things were coming out when Mr. Mayfield's family was living out in Beaverton with an enormous amount of pressure on them, under a time when the judge had put a gag order on everybody, including me, not to talk about anything secret in the case, and the FBI was out leaking this stuff.
And Brandon Mayfield has now sued the government. But we just have 30 seconds, Tom. And summing up, if you believe that your offices or home are being repeatedly broken into or spied on, surveilled by the U.S. government, yes, you filed a suit. It may be the most promising suit of all those that have been filed to challenge the government on this. But what can you do?
We just put down our head and charge forward. I intend to, on my own personal issue of coming into my office and home, I intend to proceed with the FOIA request and put everything that I know in front of a judge. The problem with the NSA is that no judge is involved, and that is our only protection, to have an independent arbiter of these issues, and that's the judiciary. The administration is attempting to circumvent that. And I think we need to, any time we can, put these issues in front of the judiciary and say, can they do this? We don't think they can.
Tom Nelson, thanks very much for being with us, an attorney in Portland, Oregon. As we turn now to Iraq. Juan?
Well, the U.S. military has launched an investigation into the killing of Iraqi civilians by U.S. forces in a raid last week. Iraqi police have accused American troops of murdering 11 civilians in the assault. According to an Iraqi police report first obtained by the Knight Ridder News Agency, the villagers were killed after U.S. troops herded them into one room of a house near the city of Balad. The dead included 5 children and 4 women and ranged in age from 6 months to 75 years old. The report said the troops burned 3 vehicles, killed the villagers' animals, and blew up the house. Local medics said the bodies of those killed had bullet wounds to the head. The U.S. military contends that only 4 civilians were killed in the raid after they came under fire while troops were trying to capture an al-Qaeda suspect. Photographs in the aftermath of the incident show locals cradling the bodies of dead children and laying out their bodies in an emotional burial ceremony.
The report of the killings is unusual because it originated with Iraqi police and because Iraqi police were willing to attach their names to it. It was compiled by the Joint Coordination Center in Tikrit, a regional security center set up with U.S. military assistance. The investigation into the killings comes hot on the heels of a U.S. Navy criminal probe into reports that Marines intentionally shot 15 civilians dead near the western town of Haditha last November. Several Iraq veterans recently told BBC's Newsnight program that the Haditha attack was not isolated. Specialist Michael Blake, who served in Balad, said it was common practice to, quote, shoot up the landscape or anything that moved after an explosion. Another veteran, specialist Jody Casey, said he was always advised to carry a shovel which he could plant on any civilian victims to make it look as though they were digging roadside bombs. We go now to Baghdad to speak with reporter Matthew Schofield. He's the European Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder News Agency, currently reporting from Iraq, the first to obtain the Iraqi police report that accused the U.S. troops of the civilian killings. We welcome you to Democracy Now, Matthew.
Thank you very much, Amy.
Can you explain exactly what you know at this point?
Well, the story, as you and just outlined it, pretty much goes through the basics of the story. We've talked quite a bit further in the last couple days with people surrounding the story, but what we have is a divergence on this story between the two. There are two accounts. There's a U.S. military account, and then there's an Iraqi police account of what happened. As you know, the U.S. military account is that after showing up and getting into a shootout to get in this house, the house collapsed during the shootout. People were killed either in the shootout or by the collapsing house. They left. They found four bodies and left. They found this suspect. They arrested him, and that's pretty much the end of the story. The other story is that the house was standing when U.S. troops went in. They were herded into one room. 11 people were herded into one room, executed. U.S. troops then blew up the house and left. We were talking with the police officer who was first on the scene earlier today. He explained the scene of arriving. He said they waited until U.S. troops had left the area and it was safe to go in. When they arrived at the house, it was in rubble. I don't know if you've seen the photos of the remains of the house, but there was very little standing. He said they expected to find bodies under the rubble. Instead, what they found was in one room of the house, in one corner of one room, there was a single man who had been shot in the head. On the directly across the room from him and against the other wall were 10 people, ranging from his 75-year-old mother-in-law to a six-month-old child, also several three-year-olds, a couple three-year-olds, a couple five-year-olds, and three other women, lined up. They were covered in bullets. They had all been shot. According to the doctor we talked to today, they'd all been shot in the head, in the chest, some of them were shot several times. The doctor said it's very difficult to determine exactly what kind of caliber gun they were shot with. So the entry wounds are generally small and round. The exit wounds are generally very large. But they were lined up along one wall. There was a blanket over the top of them, and they were under the rubble. So when the police arrived and residents came to help them start digging in, they came across the blanket. They came across the blankets. They picked the blankets up. They say at that point that the hands were handcuffed in front of the Iraqis. They've been handcuffed and shot. And the Iraqi assumption is that they were shot in front of the man across the room. They seem to be facing each other. There is nothing to corroborate that. The U.S. is now investigating this matter along with the Hadassah matter. That's kind of where we stand right now.
We're talking to Matthew Schofield. He's European Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder News Agency, speaking to us from Baghdad. Recently wrote an article on how the Iraqi police have accused the U.S. troops in Balad of executing 11 people, from a six-month-old to a 75-year-old woman. Juan.
Matthew, you mentioned the doctor that you spoke to. Was this a doctor at the local hospital? Was this a medical examiner?
This was the doctor who conducted the autopsies.
But he said that he could not determine the caliber of the bullets that were used in the killings.
Yeah, what we're looking at, I mean, I think when we hear autopsy, especially with all the crime shows on television, we have this image of kind of scientific wonder stuff going on. As he explained it, he said, "Listen, I don't have any equipment to do this with. What I have are my eyes. I examined the bodies by looking at the bodies." He did not find any powder residue on the bodies. Now, when we say this in the United States and Canada, in Europe, we see this and we say, okay, that means that there might not have been powder on the body, so maybe the shots didn't come from a very close range. It doesn't necessarily mean that, but it can mean that. However, in this case, he said, I was looking at the bodies. I didn't see the powder. What he means is not that he did chemical tests and sort of things, but he said, I physically couldn't see the powder. If you've seen the pictures of the bodies, they were covered in the concrete rubble. this thin powder of concrete covered the entire, covered them all. They were almost white from this powder, you know, chalky white from this powder. And these sorts of things. His investigation is hampered by the fact that he says, listen, this was 11 bodies came into our office. This is not a particularly big deal. We're very busy. We get between 5 and 15 bodies a day anyway.
And have you been able to determine what unit of the U.S. military was involved in the in this action?
U.S. military so far has refused to identify the unit. We've had reports from other sources on what the unit is, but until we confirm that, I don't feel that he's going out, because the U.S. is going to know the unit much better than anyone else.
You know, these stories are coming out one after another. The Haditha report, now the Navy launching a criminal investigation. This report that you have made coming out of Balad, this is the week that President Bush is launching another sort of offensive where he goes out and speaks to the public about the good news stories that are coming out of Iraq and really going after the media, saying they choose only the negative stories. Your response?
Well, if you're looking at these two stories as isolated incidents of times when Iraqis believe Americans have gone out of control and killed people, that's missing the mark by a wide margin. This is commonplace, everyday Iraqi belief. The belief over here is that this is happening all the time. What's different in these cases is that there is some level of credence given to it by U.S. investigations into the matter, by police reports. In the county next to, in the province next to Balad, it is Diyala. Diyala has officially named this the Year of the Cop, because they're very pleased with the progress Iraqi police have been making. And they want to highlight the increasing professionalism of the police. What's going on in Balad is the police are going through their investigation, and they are targeting Americans as the perpetrators in this. It's very similar to any crime, I suppose, at that level. And they're going about their business, and when we talk to them, they're saying, listen, we don't have any axe to grind here. This is just the way we're doing our work.
Now, and BBC
and say that we're ignoring the good news. I think there is on the other side an effort to ignore the depth of the bad news here.
And BBC specialist Michael Blake, serving in Balad, saying it's common practice to shoot up the landscape or anything that moved after an explosion, linking, you know, these two stories very much, Balad and Haditha. Bomb goes off, and then the attacks in the residential area around it by the U.S. military in retaliation.
I've been in several car bomb IED attacks, and the amount of gunfire laid down immediately after one of these, when you're in the presence of security forces, is amazing. There are thousands of bullets flying through the air at these moments, and all you can do is hit the ground and wait for it to end.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Matthew Schofield, European Bureau Chief for Knight Ridder News Agency, speaking to us from Baghdad. Be safe. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
As violence continues on a daily basis in Iraq, President Bush is continuing his media offensive this week. A town hall-style meeting in West Virginia Wednesday was his latest in five straight days of appearances. The president has repeatedly lauded what he called democracy in Iraq and the freedoms from living under Saddam Hussein's oppressive regime. But yet another story out of the country paints a very different picture. Shia death squads in Iraq have been systematically targeting gay Iraqis for persecution and execution. The attacks follow a death to gays fatwa issued by Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani last October. In a question and answer section of his website, Sistani says homosexuality is, quote, forbidden and calls for the killing of gays in the, quote, worst, most severe way.
The story comes in this week's issue of Gay City News. It reports that the Badr Corps have heeded Sistani's call and have been targeting gay Iraqis. The Badr Corps is the military arm of the Iranian-backed Supreme Council of the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, a powerful Shia group that's the largest political formation in Iraq's Shia community. For more on the story, we are joined by Ali Hili, a gay Muslim Iraqi living in exile in Britain. He fled Iraq 2 years ago. 5 months ago, he founded the Abu Nawas Group to support persecuted gay Iraqis. He joins us on the line from London. He doesn't want to expose his face as he's received several death threats. We're also joined on the telephone here in New York by Doug Ireland, who broke the story in the Gay City News, a columnist for The Nation magazine, Village Voice, and New York Observer for years, also contributing editor of PAS, the monthly for HIV-positive community. Ali Hili, let's begin with you in London. What exactly do you know? What was your experience in Iraq, and why have you gone into exile?
Iraq, at the time of Saddam, was, I'm talking about as a gay Iraqi, it was not as bad as we can see now. In fact, it was a little bit, we have a little bit acceptance. We have a little bit of, not too many intimidation. People are really accepting gays, especially in theaters, in entertainment, in media. We have several actors, singers, which is very popular before. There was no homophobic attitude towards gay and lesbians. Most of them are welcomed in the community, in the society, and people just we indulgence with the rest of the Iraq.
And what has happened in the period since the U.S. occupation?
Well, we started to receive information, in particular the last 2 years, when we made contact with our friends, my old friends in Baghdad, and horrific details about, killing, intimidation, harassing, arresting. It's a very dark age for gays and lesbians and transsexuals and bisexuals in Iraq right now. And the fact that Iraq has been shifted from a secular state into a religious state was completely, completely horrific. We were very modern. We were very very Western culturalized Iraq comparing to the rest of the Middle East. Why it's been shifted to this Islamic Dark Ages country?
Can you tell us about the fatwa issued by Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the section on his website that talks about homosexuality is forbidden and calls for the killing of gays in the worst, most severe way?
Okay. After the killing of one of our colleagues and his partner has been injured, it alerted us to start to search for orders of killing and attract to our attention Sistani, the highest spiritual leader for Shia in the Middle East. And on his website, we found an order for killing for gay and lesbians. In fact, I'm looking at it right now, till this moment. Nothing has been changed since we approached them. We asked them to change it and do something about it. Our sources inside Iraq told us that they used this print and send it to people from this website. So we found it, and we started to do a little campaign here in London with our little group to approach the Iraqi government and the media right now to do something about this killing.
We're also joined by journalist Doug Ireland, who broke the story in the Gay City News. Doug, welcome to Democracy Now.
Good morning, Juan.
Now, this is a human rights issue that has gotten no attention, absolutely no attention here in the United States. Could you talk about it and what you went over in your article?
Yes, the organized and systematic kidnapping and assassination of gay people in Iraq has gotten absolutely zero coverage in United States media. The killings are ongoing. They are almost a daily occurrence. I spoke this past weekend with an underground gay activist in Baghdad who told me that just in the previous week, four gay Iraqis had been found murdered in the usual style employed by the Badr Corps, which is to say the bodies are discovered with their hands bound behind their backs and bullets in the back of the head. Badr Corps, which is the military arm of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, is compiling lists of homosexuals. Many gay Iraqis are warned that if they do not get married, they will be subject to assassination. They usually give them about a month to change their ways, as they put it. And if they don't, they are targeted for murder. There have been assaults by the Badr Corps in the streets of Iraq. And since the Ayatollah Sistani's death fatwa against gays, this has given a green light for manifestations of public homophobia in the most violent way by Shia Muslims in Iraq. So you have situations where Badr Corps thugs will drag someone into the street and begin beating them, and they are then surrounded by crowds of Shia passers-by who cheer them on. It's a very desperate situation. The gay activist I spoke to in Baghdad, with practically tears in his voice, was begging the West, please, we need protection. But when gay activists have gone to the U.S. authorities in the green zone, I was told we are laughed at, and they don't care. They treat the gay Iraqis who are begging them for protection with contempt and derision, which is rather scandalous.
Ali Hilly, you left Iraq 2 years ago, living in exile now, afraid to even show your face. Were you a supporter of Saddam Hussein?
Say again? I couldn't get that a little...
Were you a supporter of Saddam Hussein?
No. Actually, personally, I have big hate for this person. He is the worst thing that ever happened to Iraq, maybe, until we saw this religious mullahs who brought to the government to lead this country. We were much better off in the Saddam time, although he's a tyrant. But Middle East is not that little simple ABC. The politics shouldn't approach Iraq in that way. Again, it's a huge, huge mistake taking off a secular state with a neighbor Islamic state. Iran has a great, huge, huge influence now on Iraqi government, and they want to adapt the Islamic Iran subversion inside Iraq and in the south. We have sources that's been telling us that several Iranians, officers and people are really working with the government, and especially the last report we got today from Mr. Mohammed al-Shahwani, the Iraqi intelligence director of the Al-Ghad newspaper. It says names and addresses belonging to Badr organization closely affiliated to the Iranian regime were discovered during a raid by the Iraqi intelligence agency against a police center last month. An Iranian were arrested during the raid in Iraq. One was charged of a television station with no authorization. He's working, and another one is an officer intelligence from Iranian regime. These horrific and facts, it's proved that Iraq has been penetrated by the Iranian regime through the mullahs and religious parties.
Ali Hilly, we want to thank you very much for being with us and for speaking out where you are now in Britain, having gone into exile from Iraq, and Doug Ireland of Gay City News for breaking this story. As we wrap now with our top story, the three surviving members of the Christian Peacemaker team have been freed after being held as hostage for almost 4 months. The British Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, announced the men had been rescued earlier today. The exact circumstances of their release remains unclear. We go now to Canada, to the co-director of the Christian Peacemaker team, Doug Pritchard. Welcome to Democracy Now! Doug, are you with us?
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what you know at this point about the freeing of the three members of the Christian Peacemaker team?
We don't have a lot of details to hand ourselves. Our remaining team in Baghdad is actually meeting with the released men as we speak, and I hope to hear more from them later today. What we have heard is that there was no violence in securing their release. No shots were fired, and in fact, there were no captors present with our three men as coalition forces arrived. So we're very grateful that there was no loss of life or injury in securing this release.
What we heard, the news reports we heard today, that Britain is saying it was a multinational force that moved in. Was it true you heard that they were led by one of the people who were holding them captive?
We have heard those reports, but we don't have any confirmation.
And what is the response of the families?
Well, certainly we, as their colleagues, are delighted. We know their families are delighted. But it is tempered for all of us by the loss of Tom Fox. We had hoped for a joyful reunion of all four of our men with their families, and so today is somewhat bittersweet. But it is certainly a time to celebrate this release as we also mourn the loss of Tom.
Well, we want to thank you very much for being with us. We also understand from the reports that Norman Kember might be in better shape, the oldest of the three, than the other two men who are in hospital. Have they been released from the hospital?
Yes, they have. And we're told
James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudan.
Yes, they were just in for checkups and that they are remarkably well. And they're now having lunch on the grounds of the British Embassy with our other Baghdad teammates.
We want to thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Doug Pritchard, co-director of the Christian Peacemaker teams in Canada. Again, James Loney, Harmeet Singh Sudan, and Norman Kember have been released and are in Baghdad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, produced by Mike Burke, Shrifa Dokadoos, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.